broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And a very good morning to everyone. I'm your host, Stephanie Sumner, and welcome to the podcast. Welcome, guys.
Good morning, Steph.
Good morning, Steph.
Good morning. Day after Valentine's Day. Did everyone go and purchase $80 flowers? Or for a single rose, I think they were about
$20? $80 set of flowers is probably about $200 yesterday.
Exactly.
No, I was certainly cashing in.
I did not. I've been married for long enough to know that I need to show my love through the entire year, not just on one day.
You're a smart man, Louis.
There was quite a few guys just down the road where the florist is from our office, and I was walking past there around about 6 o'clock last night, and there was about 35 men all lined up doing the last minute shop.
So it's actually quite a bit
boys,
of pressure.
Come on.
It's a lot of pressure for the guys, I think. So, you know, lots of women demand that their flowers are presented to them on Valentine's Day, so it's not easy.
Oh, well.
It is a nice gesture, though.
It is. Now, kicking off the week, we actually don't have Brett with us in the studio today, so it's just the three of us here.
We'll be able to talk about meaningful things then.
We won't tell him that.
Good old Brett, he's on secondment.
He's up in Brisbane, isn't he?
He's up in Brisbane.
Looking for property.
Yes, that's right. So, yep. Good luck to him.
Absolutely. Hopefully he's chasing the sunshine. He's probably having a great old time.
Yeah. Endless summer.
Yeah. So starting off the topics today, in the theme of Valentine's Day, Joel's going to talk a little bit about some data.
Data analytics. You know I love the data.
And, sure do.
Getting stuck into it. Well, we've got something in line with Valentine's Day. So I've received a research report. In fact, some of the stockbrokers that we receive research from like to come out with these, you know, funny types of analytics from time to time. We have the Melbourne Cup data analytics sweep, and today we've got some data analytics on Valentine's Day. Now, if we're looking specifically at web-based dating websites, there's been some study done to help all of those who are on the online trying to find their ideal partner.
All right.
So now, in one particular case of a where there's data, there's an analyst, right? And in one particular case, there was an analyst who, in the case of online dating, he looked at some of the key profiles and some of the key words that were most successful, and he went from being a zero hits per week person to the number one match for 30,000 women on one website, just going through and analyzing the data. So for those unwilling to go to such extreme lengths, there are some following key facts to help increase your online dating success.
Okay.
So women get 60% more attention if their photo is taken indoors.
Must be that lighting.
Men get 19% more attention if their photo is taken outdoors.
Really?
Now, full body photos boost both sexes and success by 203%, although there are some exceptions. So, no headshots, guys. No headshots, girls. We want to see the whole thing.
The full package.
Yeah, we want to see the full package. We don't want you know.
Don't just give us a
no
preview.
No surprises. Now, most people think that posing with animals is a good idea. Well, it shows that posing with animals or your best friends might seem cute, but it actually reduces your popularity by 53% for men and 42% for women.
Wow.
So there's obviously, you know, haters out there.
I do not want to date your dog.
Yeah. And I don't want to get into bed with its hair and all that sort of stuff.
That's right.
Now, men get 8% fewer messages if they put up selfies. So go and get somebody else to take a photo, guys. And mentions of the words such as divorce or separated get men 52% more messages.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so it must be because they've actually been in a long-term relationship where you'd think that they were.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So they're already broken in.
So they're not commitment phobes.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and women like to pick up a broken man, don't they?
I don't know. Well, it sounds complicated to me.
It sounds pretty complicated, but yeah, maybe it's a sign that self-esteem is low. I might have a chance here.
Yeah, the nurturers, whatever it might be. Now, women who are more forward using words like dinner, drinks, or lunch in the first message get 73% more replies, while men should play it a little bit cooler. Men who mention the same words in their opening message get 35% fewer replies.
Wow.
So, women be aggressive, men take it easy.
Wow, okay.
And men end up having to actually pick up the dinner tab, though. That's the only problem. The end of it. They might not feel that great after that.
And based on the most popular words used on OkCupid, males who surf, do yoga, ski, and like the ocean do best. Similarly for women. Women who surf and do yoga also do well, along with those who mention London and New York.
Well, okay.
Yeah, so now once you have a match, the data also shows that men are lazy when it comes to the first message. The median message length sent by men is only 12 characters compared to 122 for those gossiping, gobbling women.
That's one-tenth. Yes. One-tenth of the number of characters.
Yeah, well, they do say that women speak on average more, you know, four times more than women do.
Yeah, well, that's, you know.
Women speak four times more than what men do.
Four times is one thing. 10 times is another.
So, for men, 25% of messages are under 6 characters, presumably hello or hi.
Well, how about it?
Yeah, so suggesting... how about it? So, you know, there's some interesting numbers to kick off the Valentine's Day theme.
Good one. All right, now moving along, Joel, you've got another bit of interesting information, and you're going to be talking about the failure of the Airbus A380.
Yeah, so look, I mean, I just thought it might have been an interesting little tidbit to note that the iconic A380 will no longer be that huge, massive feat of aviation engineering where
it's falling from the sky.
I hope not.
Yeah, so Airbus have announced just in the last 24 hours that they'll no longer continue production of the A380, which is... You know, on can carry up to 600 passengers in some instances. So,
well, it's still the biggest passenger aircraft, isn't it?
It is.
Even the Boeing 787 Dreamliner is not as big passenger wise.
Yeah, most definitely, it is the largest air passenger aircraft.
Why are they decommissioning, or why are they not continuing on with them?
Well, so the A380 is a major long haul airline carrier. It has the 4 engines, and there's been a move towards more economically efficient 2-engine Dreamliners, right. And the Airbus Airbus A330 and the A350 models. So these are still long haul planes, but they're only coming with 2 engines, obviously more fuel efficient, perhaps not carrying as much as 600 passengers. In fact, I'm sure it doesn't get anywhere near that, but the airlines are finding that it's just more fuel efficient to go with those types of airlines aircrafts rather than the A380. So
the A380 was the one that Qantas had the near-air disaster with, wasn't it, in Singapore?
Coming out of Singapore, yeah. Yes. And the pilot of that airline has been doing the rounds for the last several years talking about that incident. In fact, I heard him speak at Crown about 3 or 4 years ago. It was actually, you know, a very, very compelling, interesting presentation that he runs.
Three of the engines got caught on fire with that?
I believe that's right. Yeah. Three of them. There was an issue. One of the blades in the engine, I think, severed off, and then it went through 3 of the engines, cut off the hydraulics, and yet he was still able to land it. But so that happened in 2010. But look, I don't think that had anything to do with what's going on here.
It's just the efficiency. So.
It's all around efficiency. And in fact, you know, there's been a move for cost-cutting, more rational competition in the airline space, so much so that you've even got Warren Buffett that is now starting to invest in airlines out of the US, Delta and a few others.
Because for a long time it was just an untouchable industry. No one wanted to touch it, did they?
That's right.
For years you had government-owned airlines that were, you know, competing at costs that were well below the, well below levels that were sustainable for the industry. You had a lot of irrational competition. But yeah, obviously, some of these airlines are starting to get themselves in order after coming out of bankruptcy, and that push continues today.
Well, the airlines are one thing, but the airline supplier is another thing.
Yep.
So I can only imagine when it's Airbus or Boeing, when they are building these planes, they're taking their orders years in advance. Mm.
They are.
So it's not like they may have cancelled orders, I'm not sure. But they would have years of notice. So they wouldn't lose any money on this.
Yep.
They would just see, well, we don't have 5 years worth of production ahead of us for this aircraft anymore. We don't have 3 years. We don't have 2 years of production ahead of us. It's really coming down. People are airlines are just not putting in orders for this aircraft. So we'll keep working on what's already in the pipeline, but then we'll just stop.
So that you're right. Emirates are cutting down their fleet of A380s from 162 to 123, and Emirates have been by far the largest buyer of A380s. Airbus have not made a profit on the production of the A380 over the whole 12 years.
Oh, really?
Sounds like a win for everyone then, doesn't it?
Yeah, so they're expected to take almost a $500 million charge on the A380. With closing down costs and the like. But production will continue until 2021, obviously, to fill the orders that are in place. They expect that the A380s will continue flying until around about 2030 with the existing fleets that are out there. But, just an end of an era for, when you go down to the airport and you watch those planes take off and you wonder how the hell they stay in the air.
It's phenomenal.
Don't want to think about it.
Yeah, I just thought that was quite an interesting fact to come out of the week.
It is. Look, we're just going to take a very quick break here now and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, guys, and we're just going to head back to Joel, who's going to share one of the more successful share investment strategies.
Look, I'll continue the theme. Obviously, you're listening to my voice a fair bit, so I won't
Valentine's
be too
Day
long
on airplanes.
No, I'll continue my conversation anyway. Oh, so I'm sorry, guys, you have to listen to me a little bit more.
Markets, give me more.
But look, obviously we've gone through a fairly decent correction. We're coming out of that correction at the moment. Markets are recovering extraordinarily strongly off the lows in late December. We're now into mid-February. We've seen the best January on record for some 30, 40, 50 years.
Which is a relief given we've had a pretty bad October, November and December.
Correct. Now, Citigroup just this week came out with some analysis on which investment strategies or valuation strategies actually have performed the best over the past 20 years. So there's always been this debate between growth companies and value companies and which are the best to invest in. And value companies tend to be your slower growing, low price to earnings ratio investments or higher dividend yielding investments. They're already mature businesses, and if you can buy them when they're cheap relative to the market or their intrinsic value, that has proven to be a very popular approach for many investors like David Einhorn, Warren Buffett, these types of guys. And then you've got your growth investors like your Mark Minervini's, your David Ryan's. These guys have been US investing champions multiple times, where they select very high price to earnings ratio companies that are growing revenues at a very strong pace. They're not mature. They're usually mid cap upstarts or companies that are going through a hyper growth phase. They're your Apples back in 2003 to 2007. They're your Microsofts back in the early 90s. These types of businesses before they come the household names. Well, in actual fact, Citigroup have gone and done an analysis on valuation measures using some generally accepted and commonly used valuation measures. And what they found that over the past 20 years, pretty much most of them have performed miserably as a... generally accepted metrics such as forward price to earnings ratios, where you divide the current share price by its future expected net profits, reported net profits, that has actually delivered a negative return by around about 25% over 20 years. So if you just purely relied on buying the cheapest forward price to earnings stocks over the past 20 years, you'd actually lose 20% of the value of your investment over the past 20 years when looking at global equities.
Jeez.
When looking at dividend yields, so buying stocks that have the highest dividend yields, looking at global stocks again, you would have lost close to around about 18% over the past 20 years.
Whoa.
If you're looking at price to book ratio, so which is like the liquidation value of a company, if you divide the value of the share price by the net value of its assets, which is what you would get on a fire sale if the company was liquidated, and you bought just the cheapest of those, you'd actually lose more than 60% of the value of your money just by picking the cheapest price to book ratios. What they did find, though, was that there was one measure that stood out well and truly above the rest. And that was buying companies that had the highest free cash flow yield. Now, what is free cash flow? Let's think about a profit and loss statement. And what is a profit and loss statement made up of? Revenues minus expenses minus tax leaves you with a net profit. Now, net profit is also reduced by deductions that are non-cash deductions like depreciation and amortization charges. So the profit and loss statement looks and reports profit based on an accounting measure, but not on a cash flow measure.
So you can have a very profitable company with not a lot of cash.
You can have a very profitable company with not a lot of cash. That's right, not generating a lot of cash. Or you can have a very high cash flow generating business that has depressed profit levels because of large depreciation deductions that it's taking. So free cash flow is when you add back the deductions for depreciation, which are non-cash deductions, and then you subtract the capital expenses that are required every year to keep that business going. So let's take a railroad, for instance, a train company. Every year they, charge for tickets, they have to pay their, drivers and, update maintenance and all that sort of stuff. They own the railroad or the rail carts, but those rail carts depreciate in value over time. Yeah. Okay, so they're able to claim a deduction for something that doesn't actually cost them money. It's just a decline in the value of the value of that asset. Now, that railroad company, its net profits are not being reduced by the decline in value of the assets that it owns. So therefore, you add that back because it's not a cash charge. But what you subtract then is the cost of having to replace those rail carts when they've got to the end of the cycle. So that's capital expenditure. Mm. So when you make those adjustments, you're left with what we call free cash flow, which is the amount of money after tax that shareholders are actually entitled to. Now, what they've said is that if you divide that number by the value of its share price, so you look at free cash flow per share, divide it by the share price, and you pick those that have the highest cash flow, free cash flow to relative to the share price, that is a representation of value for investors, and that measure has delivered returns in excess of 320% total returns over the past 20 years, where all of the others have actually lost money.
Can you give an example of some of those companies that would have free cash flow?
So companies that typically have strong free cash flow are companies in the IT sector. So you think about software businesses. Software companies, they develop a software package, and then basically, once you've developed the software package, the cost to continually sustain that software is pretty minimal. All you got to do is just find more and more people who want to buy it, and every time they buy a subscription or a license, that cash flow comes through the door without having to do too much more to keep that software tracking.
Right.
Or moving forward, healthcare companies are the same. So healthcare company, IT companies at the moment tend to produce the highest free cash flow relative to sales. So it's what we call free cash flow margin. Healthcare companies, so you think of pharmaceuticals, hospitals, these types of businesses that continually have strong revenues that come through because people are buying their products or paying money on those products and services regardless of what the economy is doing. They tend to not have to worry too much about, they tend to be highly profitable businesses.
So businesses that once they're set up, if they get more and more customers, it's a very low cost to servicing those customers.
Correct.
So if there's a new software subscription, Microsoft doesn't actually have to do anything. They just let you download their software. Costs them zero.
Yep.
If it's a drug manufacturer, well, to produce another 10,000 pills of something is a very low cost.
I would have thought their equipment, though, would be pretty expensive in the healthcare
sector. Well, their equipment is already set up.
Yeah.
So that's part of the initial thing. But a...
But to replace it?
To replace it, yeah, but the replacement of equipment might only happen every 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
See, a bad business would be, for example, building airplanes to come back to Airbus, because every time they take an order, they have to do a huge amount of work to fulfill every order.
Yep.
So that's a very difficult business to manage, because they're trying to make, I don't know, a 10% or 20% margin on each airplane that they manufacture. Mm. So there's a lot of cost that goes in, and they hope there's a profit at the end of it.
And so if you think at the other end of the spectrum, in terms of those that are not very attractive on a free cash flow basis, you look at companies like utility companies. So utility companies are always updating their energy infrastructure. They're always having to replace power lines. They're always having to replace, you know, expensive parts in their coal-fired, you know, coal-fired plants.
And they're passing that cost on to the person that gets the
bill. Yeah, but the problem with energy companies also, and utility companies, is that they, particularly utility companies, which are the worst at free cash flow, they also have a regulated price structure. So the government sets the price at which they can charge for their services. Whereas with IT and healthcare, you pay what the cost is, and often the difference between what the cost is of sustaining that business versus what the revenues are that you can charge for those products and services
is anything that they can.
And especially if it's critical software to the way that businesses or humans survive, or critical software to the way that your health is being conducted and being maintained, then you know people are prepared to pay premium for what is a relatively lower cost to produce. Just an interesting note there. Now, if we're having a look at where the opportunities might lie based on this measure today, we're seeing that obviously IT and healthcare are two sectors that, in particular on a global basis, represent opportunity. In particular, the US IT sector has a free cash flow yield of 6.3%, which is very, very high historically. We've also got the Asian IT sector. So think of companies like Tencent that has WeChat. Yeah. Think of Alibaba, you know, that obviously the online shopping platform.
Marketplace, yeah.
We've also got global healthcare as well on a 5.9% free cash flow yield. And interestingly, materials sector at this point in time, with the recovery of the materials prices from the resource bust that happened about 3 years ago, they're offering an attractive free cash flow yield at the moment. And communication services. Now, communication services is a new industry that has been reclassified recently, where it takes into account telecommunications companies and communication platforms. So think of Twitter, Facebook, these types of companies that are put into that communication services sector. So if you're looking for opportunities right now, focus on free cash flow yield. And right now, the opportunities in US IT, Asian IT, global healthcare sector, materials, and communication services.
Very good.
All right. Well, we're going to take another very quick break, and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back. We're now actually going to throw over to Louis, who's going to give us step number 3, following on from last week's podcast.
Thank you,
and
Steph.
Bring us home.
All right, very good. So this is week 3 of how to tidy up your finances in the new year. For those people who had a New Year's resolution to tidy up their finances and didn't get around to it in January, all through February, I'm giving steps on how to actually go about tidying up your finances. Now, in step one, I said to look at your budget in a way of just measuring your cash position on the first of the month over a 12-month period of time. So not looking at what's actually being spent, just looking at how your cash position is tracking. Mm-hmm. Step two, I said, was to review your debts, because for most households, debts is their biggest expense going on their mortgage or credit cards or personal loans. What do you think step three might be?
Reducing expenses, Louis, I would say.
That would be the typical approach, but I'm going to go a little bit different. Because if all you do in life is focus on expenses, then I think you're focusing on the wrong things.
Oh, I like this step.
Now, I'm a big believer in mindset. Ooh. And if you
so I get to spend more.
If you're, well, no.
If you're good with one and two.
More. So I don't want people to continuously focus on expenses. Mm. Because if that's all you do, you're going to slip up at some point.
Mm.
It takes constant discipline to try to always be reducing expenses, always going without, always living in scarcity. And people who always live in a scarcity mindset, they act like they're broke their whole lives.
Yep.
Yes.
And acting like you're
broke, I know people like that.
is not a fun way to be.
Yep.
There is, yes, I will have one of my steps as reducing expenses, but it's not the step I'm going to focus on today. I'm going to focus on the income side of things.
Wow.
So step three is exactly growth. How can you grow? What can you do to increase your income?
Okay.
Awesome. I think that's great.
Tell us, what's the secret?
All right. Well, of course, it depends on where your income comes from. So I'm going to put a fair bit of today's segment focusing on people who have a job, who are paid by an employer, on what they can do to increase their income.
Awesome.
And the main thing I'm going to suggest is something which takes a remarkably quick amount of time for the potential reward that you can get. And that is to ask for a pay rise.
Amazing, isn't it? How many people, I better be careful here. I hope the staff aren't listening.
We're just going to put a ban on UGC staff listening to this podcast.
But it's amazing how many people just don't go to their boss and ask for a pay rise.
Now, it's a short period of time, but it can be a very uncomfortable situation. It's an awkward social situation to manage, to ask for more when you have to work with this person every day. You're asking your manager, so there's all sorts of differences in power because they have the title of your boss or manager.
Yeah.
So there's title power. They also have reward power, the ability to be nice to you or not nice to you. So not just about giving the pay rise or not giving you the pay rise, but are they going to change their attitude towards you by giving you the shit jobs?
Well, yeah. I think another factor comes into this when asking for a pay rise.
What's that?
And that is knowing that you're actually worth it. So I've gone in twice in my lifetime, I'll say, to talk about a pay rise. And I knew that I was performing well above that level. And that's when I buy my time and actually go in and ask for it.
Right.
But before that,
yep.
You know, if you don't think that you're actually entitled to it, there's nothing worse than going to a boss and requesting that if you're not performing at the level that you should be.
Absolutely. So. If you're not performing at a good level, so if you're at risk of losing your job, it's probably an indication that you shouldn't ask for a pay rise.
Yeah.
So, of course, you have to be good at what you do.
Yeah.
And you need to understand what is your worth in the marketplace.
Mm.
So if your job is as a domestic house cleaner, there's probably other people who can clean houses just as well as you, even if you're amazing. It's just that you're not in an industry where you can really get a pay rise, because there's other people who will do the same job for the same amount of money or less. What needs to be recognized is that as awkward it is for you to ask for a pay rise, and as much as you think they might not give it to me, and what if they react badly?
Yeah.
The other side is thinking the same thing.
Mm.
So you've got fears about, well, what if I lose this job, or what if it, you know, causes a reaction? What your manager is thinking is, well, shit, what if I lose this person?
Yep.
What happens then? So they're thinking, well, re-employing someone and retraining someone is awful and terrible and is an expense to the company. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to lose their staff. So it's about how do you turn the tables and recognize, yes, I'm feeling a bit awkward about it as well, and I want to resolve it, but on the other side of the table, they're also at risk as well.
And just on that, like from an employer's perspective, and I'm probably giving away some tips here that I need to be careful about, but perhaps before asking for that pay rise, think long and hard about what value you can bring to the business and demonstrate for a period of time before you start asking for that pay rise. A boss or an employer is going to be more inclined to consider that if you have demonstrated additional value in most recent history. So you've delivered a project successfully, you've gone that extra yard for a period of time in a tough, deadline driven environment, and you've delivered and you've reached those KPIs.
And I think, that's great advice. And also I think the other thing about it is if you know that you're doing all of that and you go and ask for it, yes, it's a scary thing to have to do, and I can vouch for that. But at the end of the day, the worst thing that can happen is they say no.
Exactly.
So if you don't ask, you don't get.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. Now, let's look at the amount of value that you can get from this exercise. If it happens relatively quickly, it might be a half-hour meeting with your boss. It might be a one-hour meeting with your boss. So if you get a $1,000 pay rise for 1 hour, you've just earned $1,000 in an hour.
Not bad.
And that's if you just stay with that employer for 1 year.
Yeah.
But you're probably going to lock in that $1,000 for as long as you stay with that employer, and probably sets your expectations for the next job. So you might be locking in that $1,000 for the rest of your working life, whether that's 10, 20, 30, 40 years. If it's $1,000 over 10 years, you've just earned $10,000 in that 1 hour of asking for a pay rise.
Yeah.
Sure, it's uncomfortable, but $10,000 in an hour.
That's pretty good going.
So if that's what you can get if you successfully get a $1,000 pay rise, what if you actually learned some negotiation skills before you went into that meeting? So if you read a book or an audio book on negotiation skills, that might take you another 5 hours, 8 hours to read a book and practice some of those skills. If you then get a $2,000 a year pay rise or a $3,000 a year pay rise because you're a good negotiator, just because you read a book about it, well, in that 8 hours, if you've got an extra $2,000 per year, what's your hourly rate? $2,000 for 8 hours of effort. Maths?
Not bad.
I'm not
pretty good.
Give me the calculator.
$250 an hour.
Yeah, yeah. No,
so again, that's a really good hourly rate for reading a book.
Yeah.
And the other alternative is, and not to cut your lunch, you might be going to mention this, but is scoping out the market for new opportunities and to see what what's actually on the market and where you could actually place yourself as as your role.
Lots of other things that you can do. And you can read all kind of tips. Seek.com will have all kinds of information on how to check out the market, tools to check out your worth based on your occupation, because their job is to get you to change jobs. That's their market. So my job is to get you to look at ways that you can increase your income, and having negotiating skills is a huge kicker for being able to increase your income. So that's my message for today. There are other things people can do to increase their income. You can be an Uber driver. You can do lots of things. But I'm going to set that aside for now, because for a lot of our listeners, if you're just in a job paid by an employer, just ask for a pay rise.
Awesome. Awesome. So many times, Louis, financial advisors just focus purely on the expense side of it. But much of financial advice and financial planning is around growth. Growth personally, growth financially. And I think that's just awesome tips, because just not enough people talk about that.
Yeah, thank you. And it's the same thing as an investment portfolio. You need to be aware of the risk of losses, But your focus has to be on the growth potential.
Definitely.
The growth potential, the income potential, the profit potential of your investments. And you should be doing the same thing with your personal finances and your own career, is focusing on not so much what my expenses are. Yes, I need to be aware and I need to cut unnecessary costs, but you need to be as focused or even more focused on the top line. What is my earnings? How can I grow? Because if you can change your income by $1,000 per year every year, you're going to make a huge difference to your personal finances.
And not to leave on this note, but just to say to females out there as well, it's okay to go and ask as well, because I have a lot of friends that I've had this conversation with, and women tend to find it really, really difficult to go in and ask for a pay rise. So, you know, grab that opportunity and go for it.
Absolutely. Don't normalize what you know, because your set of skills, your value is usually fixed in our own minds, and what we think is normal everyday stuff is actually pretty amazing in someone else's eyes.
Yeah.
So don't forget that.
That's so true.
You know, Steph, just on that point, I have read a number of studies that one of the contributing reasons as why there is a pay inequality between males and females is that males are more inclined to ask for a pay rise than females are.
Yep.
Not saying that's the whole contributing reason, but it's certainly a contributor.
A factor. Yeah.
Yep. And another factor on that is that if males have most of the skills but not all of the skills, then they have a level of comfort with that, whereas females tend to think that they need to have all the skills. So again, it comes down to the perception of whether what I am doing is actually normal or not.
So true. Well, that's a great way to end today's conversation. We're now going to throw over to our favourite segment for the day, and that is You Can't Be Serious.
Yes, we love it.
Now, and we don't have Brett here today, so Joel, you better make sure that this one's a good one.
Well, once again, sticking with the Valentine's theme, how about, we've heard of Tinder, we've heard of Match.com, we've heard of, you know, all of these other websites, OkCupid and the like, Plenty of Fish. What about an app for livestock?
Yes. Okay.
It's a little bit weird.
Well, we've got Tinder. What about Tudder? A mixture of Tinders and Udders.
Just in time for Valentine's Day.
A Tinder-inspired app is helping farmers match up potential partners for their cattle.
Oh, I'm glad you said their cattle.
Tudder, which is a mix of dating app, Tinder and Udder, lets farmers swipe right on cattle they like the look of. Now, before you get any sick thoughts, it's not the farmers, you know. They're looking for matches for their cattle to match with. So, it's not a sick little website.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. Well, we'll have to wrap it up there today. But thanks again for all your insight, boys, today. And thanks again to our listeners for tuning in. And we'll speak to you all next week.
Okay.
Thanks, Steph.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.